Ladies and gentlemen, I want to welcome you all to this segment of It's Rainmaking Time. I'm Kim Greenhouse, and we're going to take care of some personal business, show business with It's Rainmaking Time before we bring in our remarkable guest. First of all, I want you all to know that because the ecosystems of the internet are in such flux and there are such major changes, not only incremental, but phenomenal changes happening online with content, the curation of content, the censorship of content, and many people are wondering what they can and can't talk about. It's Rainmaking Time has decided months ago, when I did a tribute to my late doctor, Dr. James Privitera, that was removed from YouTube, to stop providing the shows that we produce here as an addendum on YouTube. Usually we just post them to It's Rainmaking Time in audio and video, but we've decided to stop that now. We're no longer investing in YouTube the way that it conducts itself. It's part of something that's going on around the world. And we're also building a network that you'll hear about later next year. And the best way that you can support the show, if you'd like to make a contribution, is to do that, to come to itsrainmakingtime.com or CH, make a comment and share it with all the people you care about. And now let's begin with our guest. I saw our guest on a wonderful platform last year when she was talking about her discoveries about what happens to the microbiome when people got a COVID injection. Now, I know we're not supposed to talk about this today, but I was so impressed with her, the way that she asks questions, the way that she inquires about things, the way that she wants to learn and is dedicated to continuous learning. Now, we've had a lot of changes with our website and the work that we're doing here, so it's taken this long to actually get her on the show. Plus, her schedule is insane. So she is a gastroenterologist, and she is the CEO of ProgenaBiome. Her name is Dr. Sabine Hazen. She is a remarkable communicator. You will see her passion, which is infectious. She has discoveries not only about the microbiome, about the gut, about a lot of myths we have about it, but also what needs to happen in research, in reporting, in data gathering to better all of our lives, including the people in pharma. Please welcome our beloved guest, Dr. Hazen. Welcome to It's Rainmaking Time.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure. The first thing I want to get to is at the beginning of your book, there was a chapter where you talked about you and the other authors. And by the way, her book is called, oh, my God, I can't believe I'm going to say this. Let's Talk Shit, Disease, Digestion, and Fecal Transplants, with her co-authors, Shelley Ellsworth and Thomas Barodi, MD. You talked about several of the people, both the gentleman, the scientist who said, look, you know, disease really lies in the outside of the body. You know, they come from outside. It's the germ theory. And then there was a competitor that came in and said, well, it's not quite that way. It's another way. I want you to distill this to the audience because this impacts all of research and all of what we do and don't get to investigate and come up with solutions for. Take it away.
So I was quoting Antoine Béchamp and Louis Pasteur. So Louis Pasteur and Antoine Béchamp, if you go back to history, were rivals. One had a theory that it was the terrain, the microbiome, the disease that basically, you know, is the problem. One had an idea of the bacteria is the problem. Sterility is the problem, right? So not necessarily what's around us, how our body is, but really the bacteria. And therefore, if we kill the bacteria, then we are better off. So one is about killing the bacteria and one is about realizing it's really about the terrain, right, that we call. So somewhere in between. So it's an interesting rivalry between scientists, and it's really what science is all about, right? One comes up with an idea that it's the bug causing the problem, and the other one says, no, it's not the bug. It's because the body is immunosuppressed and cannot fight the bug, right? So two different visions. Somewhere in there is the truth. I think you know, I tend to look at it as probably a combination of both. In other words, and somewhere in between, right? The Louis Pasteur and Bichon, which is, you know, it's possibly the bug increasing in the microbiome, but then it's also the loss of microbes that creates the bug to allow to, that creates that, I want to say penetration, that, that demolishing, right? That, you know, virus come in when bacteria are out of balance, right? So that's really what I'm thinking more, rather than just, hey, let's just kill the bug. And I think what you've seen from the book is that, you know, I don't really call, you know, it's not about good bugs or bad bugs. It's really, and I call them agnostic bugs, right? Because it's really, you know, they're not good or bad. A good bug has a potential of being bad, and a bad bug can be good, right? You look at E. coli, you know, E. coli is very important in digestion. But then if you have an overgrowth of it, you get diarrhea, and it's not a good bug, right? So I think every bug has a potential of being good or bad. Kind of like every human, right? A human has a potential of being good or bad. You know, you give the wrong temptation and a human might do a poor decision and give into the temptation and become, you know, what we call bad. So I think it's, that's what the microbiome is. I think that's, so that's the two scientists in a nutshell.
What do you call the microbiome? Because some people say, oh, it's the gut, but what is it? What is the microbiome exactly?
Yeah, so it's,
because I think we're not confused.
Yeah, it's not, the microbiome is really the microscopic world of microbes, bacteria, viruses, fungi, parasites, just that microscopic world, right? Of bacteria mostly. And it's all around us. It's not just the microbiome of the gut. It's the microbiome of the lungs, the eyes, the nose, the skin, you know, around us, right? So on this pen is probably a trillion microbes, right?
I'm gonna faint.
Inside the pen is probably a trillion microbes. A green pepper has a lot of microbes in there. You know, a tomato has a lot of microbes, you know, from viruses to bacteria. So, and think about, you know, the collect, when you have like these farmers that are taking the blueberries from the farm, and then, you know, they put it in a basket, and then it goes into a grocery store, and that goes into a basket. So how many microbes, how many people's hands have touched those blueberries? How many microbes are in that, those blueberries, right? So when you start thinking about it, it's really a trillion bugs around us and in us. We are in an ecosystem in a way of, we are in the microbiome, right? So the microbiome is what's living in us and what's outside of us.
I wanted to talk to you, just share something with you first. There is online, there is a video of a gentleman teaching a class. It's in black and white. He talks about, he's been formerly with the CIA, and how the cure for cancer is easy. Of course, so I was watching. I was like, and
right,
he said,
right.
I don't know if you've seen this, but everybody should try to see this if you can, just to hear like what he said. And what he said was, in Russia, where there was all this radioactive contamination, and all these people were dying in one village, in a totally different village nearby, everybody was fine. Why? And he said they had certain probiotics in their system. That blew me away. And I saw that, or microbes. Okay, I think, I don't remember which one he said, but that was fascinating. And so that told me that, of all the things everybody is like cross-pollinating what they're learning about the body, that it sounds to me like the microbiome and this matter is going to be a major key to wellness, major, and that you're in the right, you're in the right profession at the right time in history. I'm not sure it's the right time in history in terms of the research, the evidence, the data gathering, and the testing that people need that they may not be able to get because of regulations.
Absolutely. I think the microbiome is the new frontier that we need to discover, that we have no idea what the hell is going on there. I think the microbiome has secrets. You know, nobody likes to play with poop, least of all me. But I went into it because I realized, like what you explained, what you showed the data. And that was something that kind of, you know, I realized during COVID too. Why are three people in a family living and not catching COVID? And why is one person having COVID, right? What's the difference between that family in their microbiome? And the discovery was amazing because it was their microbiome. It was this probiotic, this good bacteria, bifidobacteria, was present in the three people that didn't have COVID, but was absent in the person that had COVID. So the same way that, you know, how do you prevent, how do you cure cancer? We have to look into it, right? Because that same loss of bifidobacteria that I showed in COVID also happens to be present, happens to be lost in people with invasive cancer. So is it that somebody gets an invasive cancer and therefore, you know, because they don't have bifidobacteria, and another person doesn't have invasive cancer, or doesn't have cancer because they've got bifidobacteria, right? And is it just bifidobacteria? Maybe it's bifidobacteria in some people, maybe it's other microbes in other people, right? Other different races, etc. So I think the one key thing that you know, by mentioning that study from Russia, is basically to demonstrate, from the Russian physician, is to basically demonstrate, yeah, we're all different. Imagine one village has a microbiome that looks like that, and another village has another microbiome. And between the two, the one with the poor microbiome, per se,
perished.
Yeah, perished. And the one with the good microbiome, you know, survived. So is that what resiliency is? Is that what a resilient microbiome is? Is that why some people survived COVID and some people died from COVID, right? Is that why somebody gets cancer or autoimmune processes and somebody doesn't? Do they have a resilience in their microbiome?
Yeah, that's very astute. When I was born, I was born with jaundice, and I was in the hospital for 3 weeks at Cedars of Lebanon. And the doctor said to my parents, you know, she's going to be very slow in school, very bad in sports, be easy with her and the whole bit. I must have been flipping them off from inside. but anyway, after that, I was told I had 17 blood transfusions.
Wow.
Now, later in my early growing up years, I'm sharing this with you and the public because I'm bringing you an example of something. As a younger child, I had a lot of viral and bacterial infections. I was sick all the time. Like every couple months, then I would get sick and I would be put on these very strong antibiotics. So from a young person, even through the 40s, I was on tons of antibiotics my whole life, off and on, every few months, and I would get sick and sick and sick. Now, I haven't been sick in years, okay? But I am sure I'm an example, at least people my age might be, of people that was the thing to do. It was a one-shot thing, you know, one-trick pony, give them antibiotics. And we didn't know enough about the results, or maybe it was known but not shared, but it wasn't known by the doctors who were providing it. I am sure that most of the beneficial bacteria and a lot of things that could probably be helping me in later in life are gone or need to be repopulated. I mean, how much of the population would you say?
And here's the other question. Are you one of those people that can survive with very little bacteria? Because of your resilience.
That's a great question.
Right? So mm-hmm. I think when we, you know, yes, you've probably demolished, but here you are. You're still healthy. You're still, you know, fine. You still have great hair.
That's because of my will.
No, but you still have great hair. So there is something to that resilience. Maybe you didn't lose that resilient microbiome, right? So I think that's the key, right? When you look at people, when you look at why is one surviving? And then what is the role of genetics in this, right? Are your genetics superseding your microbiome, right? Or is the microbiome mm-hmm. superseding the genetics, right? So many questions. I think it's fascinating. You know, I was like you. I was given a ton of antibiotics as a kid. And basically my mom was super sterile with me and I had a lot of allergies. And then I, you know, when I gave birth to my first child, I was also super sterile with her and I gave her a lot of antibiotics, not knowing, right? I mean, you just kind of like figure out, you know, the whole microbiome later on. And then the little one, I basically did nothing. I left her play on the ground, eat everything, eat from the floor. And, you know, between the two, you know, the younger one is a little bit more resilient. Did that play a role or is it just the genetics that makes, because both girls are pretty resilient to begin with. But what I'm saying is I think there's a component of genetics and a component of microbiome and a component of interception of the two, you know. So I think one sends possibly a message to another. Who knows? I mean, I think this is the wild, wild west again. And it's a new frontier. So we have to ask questions and we have to look at every single thing. And, you know, my role during the pandemic and my role when I started the microbiome research was really to be the detective, to, you know, break that glass ceiling to understand the microbiome. You know, the microbiome is, we are born with a lot of good microbes and we die with disappearance of those good microbes. And when we die, it's the, what we deem the bad microbes are taking over our bodies and decomposing our bodies and put us back into the earth. These microbes, if you think about them, are still alive, you know? So you were born with...
We get to die and they get to live. Something's wrong with this picture.
So, but, you know, are they going back to the earth? Are they coming back in a root of a tree, in an apple? Are they, you know, where are they going? What are they doing? Are they refueling in a way, you know, refining a reservoir, a new reservoir? We're just a reservoir for microbes. I think, you know, we as humans tend to think like we're all it and this is all about us. But the reality is the microbiome was here before we were here and it will be here after we die. So, you know, we are just here for a short segment of time on the planet. So to think that it's all about us, I don't think so. I think, you know, the microbiome is, it's really about the microbiome. It's really about the beginning of life and those microbes were there and the end of life, those microbes will still be there.
Can you talk about the bifidobacteria specifically? So far, what have you sorted out about how to test for its disappearance and how to potentially treat or solve the reappearance? Go ahead and speak right now because I'm going to check the camera for something. Keep talking.
Yes.
Go ahead.
So what we discovered is we have a stool assay at ProgenaBiome, which basically is analyzing the microbiome. And, you know, we were able to have a validation of the assay. We were able to verify it. We were able to reproduce it. In other words, I can test my stools today, tomorrow, next month, next year. If I don't change anything in my diet, it should still be the same signature microbiome. That's Sabine Hazen. Of course, if I change something, I take medications, I get a virus because I was at a conference and everybody's coughing on me and I overaccumulate this virus, you know, then my microbiome is going to change a little bit. And then I hope that it's going to come back, right? But essentially, we have an assay that can, you know, that is validated, verified, and reproducible. From there, we are essentially doing clinical trials on the microbiome. It is not a consumer product. It is still a research tool. So anybody that wants to, you know, test their microbiome, they can just enter one of our 57 protocols. You know, we have Parkinson's in the microbiome, autism in the microbiome, you know, Alzheimer's, epidermolysis bullosa, psoriasis. I mean, you name it. We've kind of like covered all the diseases and all the symptoms out there to see the microbiome, right? To see what is the microbiome looking like in a Japanese that lives in Japan versus a Japanese that lives in America.
That's fantastic. That should be fully funded, that one. That should be fully funded.
Right?
What does it take to get the funding for this? Like, so that's not, it's done. What do you think?
Yeah, good luck.
What do you mean good luck? You're in the right place.
It's impossible. We couldn't even get funding to look at the microbiome of people with severe COVID versus people that had high risk exposed COVID. So
when you say you couldn't get the funding, meaning it's not just, is it the funding you're talking about?
We wrote a protocol. We wrote a grant. Yeah. It was on the front desk of the NIH. It was delivered by a senator, actually, that said, hey, this research needs to be done. You know, this doctor has saved my staff's life. I think we need to look at the microbiome, fund it, support it. No, it didn't get accepted. So, and we were as far as like going to the, you know, front desk. So there is a lot of, so here's the problem.
What if it's funded privately? Sorry to interrupt you, but what if it's funded privately? Can you still
do it? Yeah, I mean, yeah, it needs to be funded privately. It has to. Yeah. So it needs to be funded privately. I think the public needs to start, you know, we created a nonprofit actually to do all these research. And thank God some people did donate during the pandemic because that's how we were able to show all these cases. All this research is very expensive. The stool testing is very expensive. So this is basically a research protocol. It's actually 57 research protocols. So patients that have the ability to, you know, come into our protocols and get tested. So there's two pathways that they can get tested, right? So one is they read a, so the first thing is they have to read a consent. And in the consent, it tells them, look, you're going to be paying for a portion of the testing. And then the foundation's going to pay for the rest of the testing. If they can afford it, then great, they do it and we go over what we find with them. If they cannot afford it, then essentially they get put on a list until we get funding.
So how many people do you need to test, Dr. Hazen? How many people do you need to test?
Well,
to make it,
you know, the
it's FDA, considered a FDA viable test. Yeah.
Yeah. So at least, you know, at least 500 to 1,000. So, you know, we have seen right now about 100 to 200 in a lot of diseases. Autism, we probably have seen about 300 samples. You know, we want to see more, obviously, because what's interesting about the microbiome is here's the big challenges. Everybody's different. And in our differences,
you have a lot of diversity.
Yeah. In our differences is our beauty and the diversity of humanity. But also it's very difficult to compare two people if you're different, right? Everybody is eating different diets. Everybody comes from different cultures, has traveled the world, different areas, et cetera. So, you know, so that makes it difficult to kind of compare two samples. What we have noticed is families are similar. So one of my big things that I do is compare the family portrait, right? In other words, what does husband look like compared to wife? Because husband and wives are very similar because of the fact that they share, you know, common food.
Well, the intimacy alone, also the intimacy alone.
So you're sharing those microbes. Yes.
Yep.
So, you know, eventually you end up resembling your husband. You know, I've been married to my husband for 30 years and I can tell you he knows.
Congratulations. You're in Guinness Book of Records.
Especially as two doctors, it's very challenging. Because, you know, we're so busy and stressed and, you know, we try not to take the stress into the house.
And you travel a lot, I notice. You travel a lot.
I travel a lot. But, you know,
I think you need your own plane. Go ahead.
No. Too much fuel. It's fine. The way it is, it's fine. Plus, besides, it's, you know, it's better to be in a plane and diversify and meet people. So,
That's true.
What I was saying is essentially, you know, because of the differences, it's difficult. But when you look at husband and wife are very similar. And you can kind of see within the kids that there's a similarity. That's how we were able to figure out, you know, autism and, you know, as much as we could up to now. We noticed that kids with autism, the kid with the autism has an overgrowth of a certain microbe compared to the other three family members or four or five. And so that was kind of the beginning that says, wait a minute, even in autism, it's not just a one bug. Right. You would think like, okay, well, autism is just one bug. Let me start looking at the whole population of autistic kids and let me find that one bug. But actually, it's not. There's different bugs.
Probably clusters, right?
Yeah, there's different clusters, different bugs, different loss of bugs. So it's not here's the problem and the challenge is that it's not just the overgrowth of the bugs. It's also the loss of the good ones, right? it's all about balance. But what is balance? What is balance in an African in Zimbabwe versus an African in America that has, you know, has been accustomed to the American ways, American diet, completely different. So, you know, even when you look at, I have samples of people in Zimbabwe with Parkinson's, and you look at the samples of Parkinson's in America, completely different microbiomes. So we are at a research level because we need to, first of all, get validated by our agencies, right? The National Institute of Standard. And they remind me all the time that, you know, they have to standardize, it has to be standardized, and they have to reproduce my data. Otherwise, it's not worth anything. So, you know, there is an agency that is overlooking the standardization so that when someone comes in with hemoglobin of 10, it's a hemoglobin of 10, and it is not, and it's, or a hemoglobin of 12 is normal and a hemoglobin of 7 is abnormal. There needs to be a certain standard in the testing so we can, so the doctor in, you know, Michigan,
one part of the world, right?
Yeah, can do the hemoglobin and say, yeah, you know what? She's, you know, she's right. Hemoglobin of 7, RGI bleeders, they have high risk for heart attacks. We've got to transfuse. And hemoglobin of 12 is fine. We don't need to transfuse a GI bleeder. So I think so those are the challenges why the microbiome testing is not there yet. We need to analyze lots of samples. Here's the other challenge. Even if we figure out, okay, well, we've looked at 1,000 or even 10,000 samples of autistic children, and we've discovered there's 100 microbes that are similar, that are basically are, you know, could be autism, right? Could present with autism, right? Now, the other challenge is to make sure that everybody uses the same standard operating procedures to reproduce that assay to have a value, right? And here's the other big challenge. There's other microbes, the microbes that we have no idea what they mean. So I could be saying, well, you know, and I'm going to give an example because Dr. Feingold came up with this. Dr. Feingold is who basically got me into this path of the microbiome. He wrote the book on anaerobic infections. And he said to me, look, you know, Clostridium perfringens is autism, or Drosophila vibrio is autism. Okay. But while you find you have a kid that has autism and you find Drosophila vibrio, for example, or Clostridium perfringens, but then you discover there's another bug, Eubacterium or Doria or Blatia. And then you go, what are those bugs? I've never seen these bugs before. So in good conscience, as a physician, I cannot submit a report to a consumer that says, because people ask me all the time, you know, they enter these trials and they want the report. Well, can I have a report of this? I go, it's not ready for prime time yet. Why? Because the patient's going to look at this. So I'm looking at it with the eyes of a physician that has been doing, you know, over, you know, hundreds of clinical trials, has been in medicine for 30 years, has done microbiology, has done a biology bachelor, has done medicine for 4 years. You know what I mean? So when you do that, you have a different vision. When you do clinical trials for 30 years, you have a different vision of what the microbiome, and you can kind of see these microbes and say, yeah, you know what? This one is good. This one is bad. Maybe. When I give a report to a patient who has no idea what an anaerobic bacteria is, right? Or an aerobic bacteria, let alone Eubacteria or Doria or Blatia, they're going to start Googling. And there's a lot of information on Google.
Or they'll go to PubMed.
Yeah, that is, or, but even in the medical journals, you know, I review the microbiome data. I mean, I review the microbiome data, but also read all the microbiome data that's out there. There's a lot of, pardon my pun, but there's a lot of crap out there. There's, you know, you read these papers and you go, okay, they found this bacteria for constipation. Great. But did they do a colonoscopy to make sure it was purely constipation and not colon cancer blocking the colon? did they check the patient's thyroid to make sure the patient wasn't hypothyroid? So therefore, it's no longer constipation. It's hypothyroidism, right? Did they ask the patient if he's got Parkinson's, right? Therefore, it's no longer constipation. It's Parkinson's. So to me, that data right away, I look at this and I go,
it's contaminated.
I don't care. But here's the problem. I give a report to the patient. The patient's going to go straight to PubMed. It's going to find this bacteria. And it's going to go, well, no wonder I'm constipated. I've got this bacteria that they found. Let me kill that bacteria. Now they're going to start killing. And then they're going to start killing a bacteria that was probably making them resilient. And that's the biggest mistake.
I'm sorry. I just want to clarify something in here. What you're describing to me is the tension between causality and correlation. That's what you're talking about.
Yes.
So that bacteria could be correlated with this condition, but not the cause of it. Am I correct? Did I get it?
Correct. Correct. And in other words, it could be an innocent bystander. So why are you even touching it, right? So if it ain't broken, why are you touching it? So that's the problem, because there's so much out there, so much information out there that the public is lost. Listen, if I, as a physician, I'm lost in that, you know, thousands and thousands of papers that I have to like review quickly and say, yeah, garbage, garbage. They didn't look at this, garbage. They didn't go deep enough, garbage. You know, half the testing out there on the microbiome are flawed. You know, I wouldn't have opened my genetic lab if there was a lab that I felt, you know what, this is a great lab. I mean, I tell you, I've sent my stool samples to multiple labs and I've had different results, and I'm not the only one. There was a blogger that said the same thing. I remember years ago, there is no validation in that field. There is no reproducibility in the field of the microbiome. So to trust the data that's out there when the testing is not even validated or reproducible, it's a little bit hard.
I don't even know how you settle in your spirit what you have to go through, knowing what you know, having the experience that you do and the expertise that you do, and yet knowing that the microbiome focus is at its infancy in research, evaluation, testing, standardization, the whole bit. The other thing is, in reading your book, I thought it was fascinating that there were correlations or connections between the microbiome and heart disease, the microbiome and weight gain or metabolic syndrome. That didn't shock me, but it shocked me, like the number of things that were connected to the microbiome. You want to talk about any of that? Because that was pretty, I was surprised.
Yeah. So there's I had a patient that I was called in who essentially saw, I mean, a dozen doctors and actually went to a very prominent university to get fixed. He was 880 pounds.
Oh my God.
880 pounds. He couldn't move out of his bed. He's basically stuck, and God bless him. He's still alive. And, you know, he was put on a major diet. I mean, you're talking about a guy that cannot get food, cannot cheat. He has to have people helping him to bring food to him. So he was put on an extremely, you know, strict diet, low calorie. They really worked with him. The most he could lose is 20 pounds. So I was fascinated by this case because they approached me because there were some mice studies that were done where if you took the microbiome of a skinny mouse to a fat mouse, the fat mouse could be skinny and fat mouse to skinny.
I've heard that.
Yeah. So there's some animal studies on that, and you know, nothing that was really reproducible in the human world, and no clinical trials on that yet, really. I mean, I think Jessica Allegretti is working on something at Harvard, and some others are working on it, but right now, not much, right? So I was fascinated by that. So I actually looked at his microbiome, and sure enough, there was a signature microbiome that I saw there that I can't really say, well, this is it, but at least it kind of told me, because his microbiome didn't look normal, it told me that, you know what, this guy, I can trust that there's something else in him that's not making him lose weight. Maybe he's lacking the microbes that are absorbing the sugar, that are you know, helping in absorption of the sugar, that are helping in absorption of dairy, that are helping in absorption, period. So this case was very fascinating. So we decided to partner with academic center to do mice studies where we basically gave soy to mice, to skinny mice, skinny virgin mice. And what we noticed was the microbiome changed as they started gaining weight. And so this was the first publication that was that, you know, my lab has done in correlation with the obesity and metabolic syndrome. So this is the future. Again, it's at its infancy. You know, obviously we need to start seeing more overweight patients that have trouble gaining weight versus the skinny hyper metabolizers, I call them. You know, you hear of these kids. And by the way, that 880 pound patient, I have an amazing kid for him who eats like 10,000, 15,000 calories and doesn't gain a pound. And actually, that kid is a pre-med student. So, you know, I'm dying to raise the funds to do that fecal transplant on that N of one, because unfortunately, you know, to carry that patient, to bring him to a surgical center, et cetera, it's going to be expensive.
Do you have to do that to do a fecal transplant? Is it that
complicated? You have to submit. Yeah, you have to submit.
Really?
Yes, you have to submit.
Oh, my God. Why? It shouldn't be. Well, should it?
Unless the patient has Clostridium difficile, which is a bacteria we get from antibiotics, etc. Unless that patient has that, unfortunately, it is not approved in this country to do fecal transplant.
Oh my God.
Yeah, and it's actually,
is it that complicated? Just structurally, as a doctor who knows how to do it, is it complicated to do it?
It's not complicated to do it. It's a colonoscopy. You basically take some stools from a healthy donor. You put it in a blender. You blend it all. You test the stools and then you put it directly into the colon, into the cecum. It is not complicated to do. It is challenging to do because it is highly regulated. And the agencies, basically the reasoning is, well, you're playing with microbes. I'm like, yeah, well, you know, playing, if I take manure from my, for my garden, I'm playing with microbes too. Does that mean I need the FDA to help me, you know, plant my garden? So, you know, so it's interesting times that we are living in.
For sure.
I mean, I'll give you an example. Autism. I did the first case of autism with fecal transplant and we started seeing some improvement in the kid where he started saying baba, mama, and a couple of words, a couple of sentences. And he's speaking with a computer. He's no longer aggressive. You know, he went to prom in May with a girl. And, you know, it was an amazing case. It's an N of one. The FDA spoke to the mom. The mom was ecstatic. She said, you know, we were the family that always stayed home. One of us was always staying up at night and the other one would sleep so that we would watch our son so he wouldn't walk out of the house or, you know, so there was always one person staying up. And after the transplant, they actually went on a vacation, the husband and wife, for the first time in 19 years.
Wow.
So she said to her, to the FDA, she goes, look, we know we're far from attaining cures in autism, but this is life changing. I have my life back, you know, where I don't have to worry about sleeping. I don't see my kid banging his head on the wall. So here I thought, slam dunk, I signed, you know, a form for the FDA thinking, okay, they're going to approve my 30 patients now because I've done one case. And it's been 4 years. We're still not approved to do 30 patients when we've shown that one patient is improved. So it's tremendously, it's regulated, but I think it's also controlled by, you know, companies that want to make a pharmaceutical product out of it.
Yeah.
And they're probably going to find out that it's actually not a pharmaceutical product, unfortunately, but it's going to be 20 years from now till they realize it. But till then, we'll see. Keep doing what we're doing.
Wow. Wow. That is, you know, so if somebody wanted to get, if people listening to this wanted to get a baseline context for their own microbiome, could they work with my Progenobiome?
Yeah, so they can work. They have to sign a consent. They have to basically, you know what it entails, which means I'm going to have a Zoom meeting with them for like 30 minutes to explain what I'm seeing. and what I'm seeing compared to people that are, you know, like them, but healthier, or comparing them to their family members, et cetera. So I basically, you know, show them the portal and the what we're finding. And then we're working on trying to restore the microbiome, trying to restore that bifidobacteria, right? So right now, what we have assessed that is pretty much, you know, I can, you know, put my career on this is the bifidobacteria and the importance of bifidobacteria. Because we noticed that it's not present in Crohn's patients that have never been treated. It's absent in Lyme disease. It's absent in invasive cancer. It's absent in people that are dying in nursing homes and hospice. It is present in newborns and healthy people. So bifidobacteria is really, and that's the $1 trillion industry of probiotics out there trying to correct this.
Is that an autoimmune thing? Does it also affect autoimmune? Does autoimmune?
Yes, it can.
Also?
We're coming out with data. Okay. Yeah, showing that. So it's going to be, you know, we're going to come out with an assay that's basically a BIF stick, bifidobacteria, where you could just test it, get a result within 24 hours. We're still trying to validate that. We need like severe patients to kind of show that, you know, cancer patients, severe patients have zero bifidobacteria. So we're trying to isolate to do that. Once we validate that, then we're probably going to bring it to doctors, still at a research tool, because I want doctors to play with it and kind of understand themselves. And then what's going to be important about that is that when they do treat the patients, they can see, is the probiotic they're giving working or not? So in other words, you start off with zero bifidobacteria. I'm giving you a probiotic. If I don't see that probiotic in your stools in a week, a month, you know, 2 months, then we have a problem. That probiotic is probably dead bacteria or doesn't even have bifidobacteria in there.
There are so many new tests now that people are taking, you know, yes. even, you know, the hormone test ones went from saliva to 24 hour urine tests.
Right.
They test for peptides. They test for all kinds of stuff, as you know, and I'd like to talk to you about that in a moment. But I would think that this would be like a next generation, this stick that you're going to come up with, this test for this particular bacteria would be very important since this is one of your discoveries that
yes.
you've noticed.
Yes. So that's one test. The second test is really this assay that we've, you know, been using and been publishing on, which gives us a quantification, a quantity of bifidobacteria. Because the BIF stick is really just, is it present? Is it absent? Right? Like quick test. The flora test, which is the next generation sequencing test, is super deep. And it's the whole entire genome of the bacteria. So that test is what I want the agencies to start saying, okay, you know what? Submit it and let's get it out there. For doctors, and we're trying to get as many doctors to start using it anyways right now as a research. One, you know, because the patients sign consent, they're protected because they don't have to tell the patients, hey, you know, we're at the beginning of this. This is research. So there's no, you know.
They're not worried about their liability.
Yeah. And there's no misleading the consumer. You're being upfront with them to say, look, you're entering a research on the microbiome. So I would think that's more, you know, protective than, hey, take this test that's a consumer product that shows your microbiome compared to a normal. Well, what is a normal in the microbiome space? You know, there is no such thing as a normal in the microbiome space because we're all different. So you can't really compare two individuals per se. I think you can compare, you know, when you look at one group of microbes, the bifidobacteria, for example, yes, you can compare that. To say, okay, well, let's just focus on the bifidobacteria right now and focus on, is it present or is it absent? Because we are noticing that the process of aging is loss of bifidobacteria. So I think bifidobacteria in the future might become the hemoglobin of the CBC. So in other words,
wow.
I'm bleeding.
Wow. That's a profound statement.
Right? Because right now we have no idea what's going on and we have no standard. Now, you know, hemoglobin, remember, you're bleeding, your hemoglobin is 7, you need a blood transfusion. We have no idea in the microbiome space what is a good bifidobacteria level. And we have to make sure that whatever we tell the patients that that bifidobacteria level is, it reflects it, removing from the equation the fact that the patient was on probiotics, eating yogurt, etc. So when you normalize those stool samples and you say you have zero bifidobacteria, it's a true representation of zero bifidobacteria. We're not there yet in the world. I believe we are at ProgenaBiome. Because like I said, I'm able to test my microbiome the day. Like if I do nothing, my microbiome is the same bifidobacteria today, tomorrow, next month. If I start taking vitamin C, I'm going to notice an increase, a bump in my bifidobacteria because I'm now taking vitamin C, which is which we demonstrated increases the bifidobacteria. So we were the lab that actually
That's fascinating. Hold on there. Hold on. That's fascinating. Yes. I did an entire show on vitamin C. And one of the things that came out of it, just to share with you, I'm sure you know this already, is that most of the vitamin C that has entered the United States has come from China, except for two suppliers. One provides it out of Europe and another one, and then the Vitamin C Foundation. And so you're not getting what you think you're getting in most vitamin C products. Am I correct here?
100%
in the current day.
Yeah. Okay, and
so
by the way,
measuring. Yeah.
By the way, I created my own vitamins during the pandemic because exactly that.
Oh my God.
So the vitamin C that we tested was pure and was made in America and didn't have any, and I, even though it was given to me from a factory, I retested it myself to make sure it was pure. Because I was like, well, I'm not going to give, when you're testing vitamin C in patients, you can't, you have to have the same vitamin C, right? You can't say, oh, just take 10,000 of vitamin C.
Right. Because they're not all the same at all.
Not all vitamin C's are the same. In fact, CVS, you know, anyways, I'm not going to say they're vitamin C. Do your own research. But the bottom line is you're absolutely right. A lot of vitamin C come from China. And I'm sorry to say don't have the same.
It's the way it is.
But they don't have the same sanitary, you know, and not saying that
general.
Sanitary is good or not. I mean, for their country, that's probably perfect because they live in that constant environment. You know, I mean, I've been to China. I've been in the depth of China.
Where did you go? Where did you go?
I went to Nanjing. I went to Beijing. I went to, you know, I've been all over because I lectured in Nanjing. So we kind of took a trip. And when you go off the beaten path, right, into those little villages and you go to a bathroom and you see the bathroom as a hole, you know, you're not in Kansas anymore. Right. So
I saw that in India, my first time out of the country.
And then
to India.
Toilet paper, maybe no toilet paper, you know.
I'm going to faint. Here we go.
Yeah. So here's the thing, right? So, you know, a resilient microbiome can handle all this, right? A resilient microbiome can kind of be exposed to all those microbes in that environment. If you live in a sterile environment your whole life and you don't step out of that world, then you're susceptible to that world, right? So to me, vitamin C, that was, you know, in all over. I just didn't trust it.
Yeah. You have to know your supplier, too, and you have to know what they're doing.
You have to know it, and you have to do supervision, I think. You know, even with ivermectin, I hired an independent lab than our lab to make sure that the ivermectin I was getting was actually the ivermectin I needed, because there was a lot of ivermectin out there that were just like, you know, fraudulent ivermectin just to sell, you know, pills to take. You know, because there's so much PR on ivermectin. So I think we have to be vigilant. We have to know where we make, where those products are coming from, you know. So we discovered. So because I was paranoid, and I'm okay to say that, because I think paranoid people live a little bit longer. you know, I made my own vitamins and started my own clinical trials looking at vitamin C before and after. Why vitamin C? Because actually vitamin C is one of the substances they use to make probiotics to grow. So if you look at the in vitro studies of vitamin C, if you put it in a petri dish and you put bifidobacteria and you give it some, you know, vitamin C, bifidobacteria is going to start growing. So in a petri dish, it's growing, and in humans, it's growing.
That's but here's the thing. Most significant thing to hear. I mean, even today.
Yeah.
Right now,
and
that's amazing.
And it tells you why the importance of vitamin C through the ages, you know, at fixing, you know, viruses, you know, a person, you know, think about emergency, that school teacher that started taking emergency and all of a sudden she didn't have any colds anymore, right? I mean, it's in there. It's emergency. It's vitamin C, right? And
by the way, I interviewed
C.
that guy too, 30
Did
years
you?
Ago. Yes, wow. Jay Patrick, before he passed.
Wow. Well, yeah. So
it's
vitamin
a different
C-
product now, though. It's a different product now, though.
But yeah.
I'm sure yours sure. is. I'm sure yours is different.
No, mine is, you know, I take it myself, so I'm very cautious. Mm-hmm. I give it to my kids, so I'm very cautious. So we analyze everything, trust me. And we test,
sure
you know,
do.
I test my microbiome. I tell my husband that he has an expensive wife because most wives, you know, buying shoes or going on fancy trips. I'm testing my poop for like a couple thousand dollars every 2 weeks to a month. So,
you
know,
it really require that? Does it really require that?
I do it just for me, just to see where am I at, you know? And also, you know, I'm part of the story, right? I mean, I started the pandemic on the front line without a mask. I traveled Zimbabwe without a mask. I traveled.
Wow.
So I was in Singapore, you know, so, you know, there was, I was testing every time, like I go to Zimbabwe and I wanted to see, did my microbiome change while I was in Africa? You know,
it has to have, didn't it?
A little bit.
A little bit.
I'll tell you where it changed. It changed when I went to Morocco.
Oh boy.
In the desert at 104 degrees in the middle of July. And I got toxic E. coli there. That's when it changed.
Oh my God. And what did you do?
I took, you know, my bovine immunoglobulins and fixed it. So, but I was fortunate to have the test to kind of see what was going on there.
Wow.
But,
wow.
You know, otherwise I would have probably taken some antibiotics, you know, and said, oh, traveler's diarrhea. But no, in fact, it was toxic E. coli. So, and it took a while to kind of clear out of my system, but I knew exactly where I got it. It was in the middle of the desert in a tent, and I had to have ice cubes with my drink, and the ice cubes came from the well water. And then sure enough, everybody in the family was sick, you know, when we got
I'm
back
sure.
home. So, you know, so that's when it changed a little bit, but it's not like I accumulated an overgrowth of other microbes. It's just E. coli just popped up.
It's the gift that keeps on giving. Let me ask you this. Where are you at about, at this current time, regarding peptides and a peptide like, what was it called? BPC 157. Are you familiar with that?
I'm studying all peptides. I think peptides are going to be the future. I think we're going to, as we are figuring out these microbes, we're going to figure out what they're needing, right? And I think peptides is definitely one of the, you know, factors that's going to be coming to play. Much like, you know, bifidobacteria needed vitamin C to grow, you know, maybe there's microbes that are needing X peptide, et cetera. So I think, you know, peptides is the next frontier as well.
Are you familiar with a scientist named Dr. Ben Beckman out of Utah?
No.
He is the most remarkable scientist in the fat cell and metabolism area. He's published. He's one of the most receptive scientists I think I've ever seen. One of the few very receptive scientists. And as I read in your book about the microbiome and metabolic syndrome, I thought it'd be very interesting just to maybe talk for you both to talk with each other. Just
yeah, I'd love to.
Because
yeah.
it, I think even though he's in the fat cell area and fat metabolism area, mm-hmm. it would be very interesting to share your findings.
Oh,
you know,
absolutely.
Some of the findings with Dr. Ben Beckman. We haven't had him on yet. He's a mystery. Why? I don't know why. But I really think that you two should speak with each other. A lot of cross-pollination. So,
yeah, I love those kind of physicians that are out there, like doing.
He's actually a scientist. He's not a physician, but he's a scientist.
No, but scientists,
he's a research scientist.
But even
yeah.
scientists that are out there doing that are looking at a different way. You know, I work with
he's
a doctor
incredible.
Who's who's worked with peptides. I work with a physician, a scientist that's done, that does stem cells. I work with physicians that do, you know, hypothalamus, hacking, to put it that way, Dr. Sheldon Jordan. So I work with a lot of people that are basically out there doing, because I think it all,
they're in the frontier together. Like you in their area.
Yeah.
Right?
And it's funny because when we meet and, you know, like Dr. Sasha Bistritsky is doing some amazing work on anxiety and depression with ultrasound waves. Right. And then Dr. Jordan is doing this hacking of the hypothalamus. And so when you look at all that and you go, well, maybe all of it works, right? Maybe
there's something to all of it.
Maybe it, like, for example, autism, right? And I tell this to kids with, to families with autism, look, not everything is microbiome, because everybody comes to me, fecal transplant. But if I don't really see something that's abnormal and one kid has autism, but the other kid doesn't have autism, but they look identical in their microbiome, I'm not going to say, yes, I'm going to do fecal transplant on this kid because, and yes, give it. So maybe we could say, well, yes, do it. But then you'll notice like it's not going to work. That kid probably fits into another protocol, right? A stem cell, a biologic, a neurological hacking, right? So it's important to work with doctors that are out there. You know, Arthur Krigsman is doing some amazing work with biologics and autism because he feels that autism is like Crohn's disease. Well, there's a certain population that I feel like, you know what, go to Dr. Krigsman to try to see if that helps them, right? And some kids do come out of it with biologics, some don't. Those kids come back, then we try stem cells, you know, those kids improve with stem cell. And then if they're, when all fails, you kind of go back, okay, well, it's time for fecal transplant because that's really the last frontier that we haven't really looked at. You know, other, you know, I'm sure in the future there's going to be a consortium of proteins, for example. But I think in general, you know, we need to accelerate the science. It takes too long to innovate. It takes too long for kids to have, you know, solutions. And so that's kind of my job in a way, I think.
We're going to go to a quick break and we'll be right back with Dr. Sabine Hazen. And you're watching It's Rainmaking Time. A lot of the public is inserting either prebiotics or probiotics. There's so many of them on the market. Some people have risen to fame by having a certain kind of probiotic that's supposedly the best probiotic. When I saw the teacher that was teaching a class about and talking about his, you know, his background with the CIA and how the certain probiotics in people's system prevented them from getting cancer, I was looking all over the place. Now, I don't have cancer. I have no intention to have cancer, but I thought it was interesting. And then a lot of people are doing their own self-doctoring, you know, like
yes,
trying this thing and this yes, supplement and that supplement. I admire it, but I think with probiotics, correct me if I'm wrong, I'm not sure that's a great idea. Is it? It's because there's too many and you don't have a baseline. You don't know what's going on and you're not working with a professional. Am I right or wrong?
And I just tweeted that just the other day because everybody thinks the answer.
I missed that. God help me.
It's okay. Everybody thinks
explain.
It's probiotics, it's probiotics, right? Like you're missing bifidobacteria. It's simple. You take bifidobacteria, you're fixed, right? problem number one, 16 out of 17 probiotics on the market do not have bifidobacteria in there. So right off the bat, you could be reading this product and you turn the bottle and it says bifidobacteria, but it actually doesn't have bifidobacteria because there is no quality check. That is the big problem we have in this country that people don't realize. They think the FDA goes into these factories and starts spot checking these products. They don't. They, you know, the most of the time they're just looking at the paperwork. So the majority of products, and the FDA doesn't have the manpower to do that. Think about the thousands of products that are coming out on the market every single day. You know, you.
Well, I think if it's up to the FDA, doctor, I think if it's up to the FDA, they'd cancel all supplements, all of them. If they
and probiotics.
They blink their eyes, they would all be gone. I think that's the kind of spirit of the FDA. It's sad, but it's it looks like it's true. I mean, they took avocado extract off the market years ago.
They cannot control the quality. And therefore, unfortunately, so we have a lot of companies that are shady that are selling probiotics that are not good quality. So that's number one. Number two, is the probiotic, let's say, yes, the lab did a great job at, you know, growing those bifidobacteria, did a great job at putting it in capsules and then puts it in the shelves. Is that bacteria alive by the time you're about to put it in your mouth? Remember, bacteria is supposed to mimic your gut. It's supposed to be anaerobic. It doesn't breathe oxygen. So if it was exposed to oxygen at any point in time, did it get killed? And now are you taking a dead bacteria? What is that dead bacteria doing to your live microbiome, right? And here's the other problem. Let's say you have already your factory of bifidobacteria. Why are you taking more bifidobacteria if your body is making it, right? Are you then stopping your ability to make probiotics, right? So in other words, like I'm taking pancreatic enzymes, but my pancreas is great. Well, eventually my pancreas is going to say, well, she's going to give me pancreatic enzymes. Why do I need to make pancreatic enzyme? Forget it.
Can I just stop right here with you for 1 second? Because what you're saying is very much the approach of Chinese acupuncturists in medicine. Because like I take thyroid. Since I was 12 years old, I was hypothyroid, and I was a tournament tennis player. They didn't know. I was like the early days of diagnosing thyroid. I've had to change to different types of thyroid. I want off of it. I want to be done with it. And yet, you know, I can't do it yet. But I guess the reason that I wanted to bring that up to you is that there are so many – There's people taking things, and what you just said is exactly the Chinese medicine philosophy, which is that if you start like self-doctoring with supplements, your maybe parts of your organ systems are going to, and your physiology and biology is going to not work as efficiently, or maybe stop working.
Absolutely. And even like things like, listen, everything you give your body, you start craving it. Everything you give your body, your body keeps needing it, right? So if I'm taking pancreatic enzymes, it's definitely easier than my body making the pancreatic enzyme. So it's going to keep wanting those pancreatic enzymes, right? Everything, and again, and I'm going to reemphasize this, anything you put in your body, you start eating sugar every day, your body's going to crave sugar. You start drinking alcohol every day, your body's going to start craving alcohol. French fries, your body's going to start craving French fries. So anything we give our microbiome is going to start getting used to it and crave it. So I think to me, the big mistakes that people make is giving their children probiotics. Your child is a factory of probiotics. Where are those probiotics coming from? They're coming from newborns, right? They're coming from infants that have bifidobacteria, right? I mean, those cultures, those bugs, where do they come from, right? So why are you giving your baby, which is the factory of probiotics, a probiotic? It makes no sense. And especially a probiotic that's made in a factory. Here's problem number 4 or 5. The factory has contaminants. The factory's, you know, pipes may be rusted one day. The handling, microbes could go into it. You know, when we started looking at even products like drinks that say bifidobacteria, we tested 26 to 29 products.
Oh my God.
At different grocery stores around, because what happened was I killed my bifidobacteria during the pandemic. I had a hard time bringing it up. So I started drinking a lot of kefir. And why am I not increasing my bifidobacteria? I'm drinking a ton of kefir, and the kefir said bifidobacteria behind it, right? I tested the kefir. There was no bifidobacteria. Now, people could say, well, it was all the way at the bottom. Well, guess what? I shook the bottle to make sure it was homogenous, and I tested it, and it was still no bifidobacteria. Now, I went to the grocery store, started testing all the products. Well, guess what? Only 3 out of the 26 products had bifidobacteria. And so this is another problem, right? Because here you are, you have zero bifidobacteria. First of all, you got your test from some lab that's out there as a consumer that's selling their own probiotics right there. That's a red flag. Stay away from that, because they're just going to tell you have zero bifidobacteria to sell you the probiotics. So let's say I tell you you have zero bifidobacteria, you're going to start going out there and you're not going to know what to take. But if you don't even have a test and you don't even know what you're doing, you're going out there blindly and you're taking probiotics one after the other, you could get yourself into a bigger problem than what you started off.
And so it's a big deal. It's a big deal. I think the take home for the public, what you're saying is a huge deal, because it's not just another supplement.
No.
Correct?
No. Is that correct? It's a microbe. It's a microbe, and it's a microbe. So here's one of the things we discovered out of the 26 products. One of the products had a bacteria that actually causes nausea, vomiting, and diarrhea. Be serious.
Sounds lovely.
So here's the patient's drinking this to get better, and then he's going to have vomiting, diarrhea, thinking he's got traveler's diarrhea, right? So that's what I'm saying, is there's no quality check. Here's the other thing. Is the store that you bought the yogurts at, did they leave it over the counter for 4 hours, 5 hours before putting it into the fridge? You know,
that's
you have
a good
to trust.
Point.
And so here you are. So I'm extremely vigilant, right? I as vigilant as I can be, right? And probably again, that paranoia of, you know, so I make my own vitamins. I make sure I test my yogurts. You know, I make sure, where do I buy my foods and vegetables? So, you know, I know my farmer. I know if I eat meat, I know who's killing the beef and how they're killing it. And, you know, I work with 3 farms. I test the microbiome of the beef, the cows. So, you know, I'm comfortable. But, you know, then there's also cook the meat properly. You know, I mean,
yes.
And here's the thing about the messenger RNA, because people, and I think we have to kind of give optimism to people and not just, you know, freak them out. Even if the cow is vaccinated, yes, the beef is probably not that great, but if you cook it properly, you should be fine. And also, you know, the reality.
Can you say that with 100% confidence or with a little lower confidence?
I think if you cook the beef properly, like, you know, low temperature for hours. Yeah, I think you should be fine. I mean, think about, again, the Sahara Desert, right? Where these Bedouins are cooking meat, you know, in the middle of, you
Please.
Know.
Oh, my God.
With E. coli, right. And they're cooking in this tangine for hours. So
but that's
I think
not the same as
fine.
mRNA, though, is it?
No.
Not well, the same.
But here's the thing about thing. mRNA, right? And this is my... You see that there's a percentage of people that are really affected by mRNA, and some people are dying from it. And unfortunately, it's a shame that nobody's really paying attention to that. Because to me, you know, we have to pay attention to the small numbers. The majority probably are fine. We don't know yet until, you know, years will pass. But I think one of the reasons that they're probably fine is because by the time it went from that freezer minus 80, to sitting on the counter, it was probably dead by the time it goes into their arm. You know, I think the first 3-4
That's
people that got injected, you know, were the people that got the problems, because it was a live, you know, good, you know, small portion of the spike protein. But for, you know, the majority, I think, you know, if you look at these CVS and everything, they left the bottle over the counter for a day. whatever, and then they gave it to patients. So I think the majority, the way that the injection was done and the quality was probably to their advantage, and that's probably why they didn't get affected so much.
And also probably they were varied the way they were.
Yeah. But again,
some were provided mRNA and some were provided saline. Remember the testing?
Yeah. Yeah. There was, and also apparently
they were separated.
Yeah. There were different batches and,
yeah,
you know, and there's contaminants in some batches, et cetera. So, you know, this is the problem again with a vaccine for all, a new technology for all, and believing that we're all the same. You know, I think what this pandemic forgot is that there are those people that are resilient. Why are you, you know, like, look at you. I mean, here you are, you've gotten antibiotics, you've gotten all these problems as a kid, but you're still here. You're still standing, you're still surviving. And so there is something to be said about, you know, do we need to vaccinate the whole world when only a few are, well, now it's a bigger than few, majority, you know, right, immunosuppressed, right? So yeah. I think, you know, the big problem is there are those people that are doing it right, that are using their immunity the way it should be, God's given immunity, and can go outside and can be exposed to microbes. And there are those people who did it wrong. You know, the person who's eating 12 donuts, drinking a bottle of alcohol every night, you know, the person that's using drugs, the person that's, you know, those people have trashed their bodies and therefore have no immunity left. They're susceptible. You know, I saw a case the other day of somebody questioned, you know, a patient died because a little girl didn't get vaccinated with the MMR and the guy died of measles, right? And I looked at the case, right? And the patient was not a healthy patient. It was an immunosuppressed patient. So, and it dawned on me to say, are we vaccinated? Are we vaccinated? Because I had measles, mumps, and rubella as a kid. I survived fine. Did you have it? Yes.
Well, I had the injections. I don't know. I don't, it's been a long time.
Well, and here's the thing. I had measles, mumps, rubella as a kid. And then I had the injection in residency and had a huge allergic reaction and then became allergic to dairy, wheat, etc.
Wow.
Which brings me to the point. Why are we vaccinating people that already have been immune to measles, right? Why did I need to get vaccinated? I already had measles, mumps, and rubella as a kid, right? So it's the same thing with COVID, except COVID is a little bit different in that this virus is mutating. So you're constantly catching up to the virus, right? I mean, to me, the idea of vaccinating against a virus is ridiculous. Why? Because viruses mutate. And if they mutate, you're never catching on to them. And so you're always yesterday's strain for tomorrow's, you know, so that's not the, you know, I would build up the microbiome for viruses. I wouldn't vaccinate against a virus because what we showed from our data is exactly that, that if you before and after vaccination, we notice loss of bifidobacteria. So is that transient? Is that permanent? We did notice in at least a dozen patients that it persisted in killing the bifidobacteria. Now we're following all these people to see what are they developing from killing their bifidobacteria. You know, that's research, right? That's why you can't just stop and say, no, there's no problem. We don't need to talk about it. Vaccines are safe and effective. No, there is a problem. If 30 people are mentioning, if 30 people out of 100, out of 1,000 are mentioning they're having a side effect from the vaccine, you need to pay attention. Because here's the thing. As a gastroenterologist, I'm doing colonoscopy on everyone over the age of 45 to prevent colon cancer that is found in 32.5 out of 100,000 people. So I'm doing a colonoscopy for everyone at the age of 45 and above for diagnosing 32 people out of 100,000 because we paid attention to those 32 people that had colon cancer. We need to do the same thing and pay attention to that minority.
That's a great example, doctor. That's a great example.
We need to pay attention. But here we are. Sorry, you can't talk about it because, you know, pharma's listening. You know, it's a business. They're paying the journals. They're paying the academic center. They're paying the FDA. They're paying the NIH. They're giving the grants. So
Bill Gates is also doing it.
I'm sorry.
You know that. Bill Gates is also heavily paying.
Bill Gates is funding the venture capitalist. He's the king.
Yes. Yeah.
He's the king paying. You know, but here's the thing. Bill Gates is going to be a patient at some point, right? His dad had Alzheimer's. So if Alzheimer's is a genetic problem, well, he's right in path. If Alzheimer's is a microbiome problem and he's inherited the microbes from his dad, then he's still in path. So I think Bill Gates needs to let scientists do their thing and doctors do their thing and not interfere, because interference with research affects all of us.
Okay. Do you want to know who is Bill Gates' microbiome advisor?
Go ahead.
And it's not a microbiome advisor. Bill Gates' advisor is Ray Kurzweil from the Singularity Is Near. Okay, Ray Kurzweil. So we have a transhuman influence on Bill Gates. We have a eugenicist influence on Bill Gates. And we have a complete, this is complete what's happening. Not to give any more attention to him, but just to note that it's those forces that real pure research scientists and doctors are up against, just to do their work, just to contribute.
Yes,
and
Our role, right, is the light, right?
When that's there's true. Darkness, that's true.
Bring the light. And our role is to show those people that are in the darkness the reality of life is just temporary. Bill Gates is not going to be here in 40, 50 years. You know, his advisor is not going to be there. So, you know, it's just a moment in time that we are here. We have an opportunity right now to understand the microbiome, and the microbiome can delay his Alzheimer's progression, can delay problems. So I think it would be a win-win for those people to start seeing into themselves. It's funny because I speak about this to a lot of people, and people that are trans and people that are, you know, a different view of myself, you know, because, you know, I'm pretty conservative in my ways. But I am a people's person, and I do respect humanity and humanity's choice. You know, you want to be whoever you want to be, your choice. Just don't push it on me. You want to get vaccinated, get vaccinated. Don't push it on me, because I've done my homework. I've done my research. So, you know, to those people, even to those people, they realize the importance of the microbiome. They realize, wait a minute, maybe there is something in me that's missing microbes. Maybe, you know, I need to start looking into this path because I could be a certain way, right? So,
but not every person talking about the microbiome, doctor, is as rigorous as you are and have been in terms of reading the papers, you know, reading all the research papers, staying up on things, putting things together, connecting dots, because your energy is dedicated to solving a lot of disease.
Yeah. And frankly, I put my money in it. You know, I mean, I've spent millions on this. That could have been my retirement. So thankfully, my husband and I did very well as a gastroenterology and cardiology. But the reality is, you know, I didn't have to do any of it. I did it because I feel humanity is at a tipping point where we are going to go extinct. Out of 1,000 stool samples that we've analyzed in the last 6 months, 5% had bifidobacteria, and one patient had Lactococcus, Lactobacillus. One out of 1,000. That's alarming. That's a serious amount of microbes that are lost. So here's the thing.
Don't you think it's from the food supply too? I just want to add this. I just want to hear what you
say. Of course it's the food supply.
The food supply is part of it as well.
Of course it's the food
supply. Water supply.
But here's the thing. It's more than the food. It's more than the water. It's more than the antibiotics. It's more than the vaccine. It's the stress we put on each other. It's the fears. It's the constant reminder of that we're dying that we put on each other. People have stopped laughing. People have stopped loving. People have stopped, you know, what did we do during this pandemic? We kept everybody at home. Grandparents weren't allowed to see their grandchild. A grandparent lives through their grandchild. You know, I joke with my kid, because when she comes and visits me, I go, come here, you know, give me some of that cheek microbiome. I want to stay younger, you know? So I'm like rubbing my cheek next to her, right? it's how you stay alive, you know, that symbiosis of your grandchild and you, you know. And there's been a lot of studies on that show that, you know, grandchildren that see their grandparents, the grandparents live longer, right? So
absolutely.
I think it's not just what we put. Listen, we live in a toxic world. You know, they've made money from water. You can't even buy water anymore unless it's like in a can or in a water bottle. And there's probably in that can that I just showed you right now, there's probably a lot of toxic chemicals in there from the pipe that have been like rusted, filling in these cans with water. You know, here we have water from the sky that is pure water. So we've made a business out of water.
Everything.
We've made a business out of milk. Milk is becoming a pharmaceutical product. You're talking about peptides. I mean, peptides is a protein, you know, from food, you know, so we've extracted that. We've made it into a small, you know, nutraceutical so that we could sell. We've made a business out of vitamins because our vitamins are oranges
depleted.
Are manipulated.
Yes.
Our corn is manipulated. Our food supply is manipulated. The fish has too much dye, too much mercury. The beef has too much, you know, E. coli and all sorts of other things. So we live in a toxic world, and slowly, slowly we're diluting our microbiome. When you look at the microbiome of Africans, And I was there analyzing it. They have tons of phyla, right? In the middle of the jungles of Africa, in the middle of the safari, you know, nowhere land in Zimbabwe, you know, the guide had a diverse microbiome full of different phyla, right? Then you come to America and we barely have three phylum, right? So, you know, what is that doing, you know, long term, and what's going to happen to humanity as, you know, we lose more and more microbes? Eventually, I'll tell you what's going to happen. The air is going to be toxic. You're not going to be able to go outside and breathe in the plants because the plants have a ton of viruses on them that you're breathing in. And now you're going to get those viruses and then you're going to get sick from it. So you're going to need oxygen. So now they're going to sell you oxygen in a mask. We're going to be the Jetsons in about 20 years.
I mean, they're trying to get rid of CO2, which is so insane. I did a whole show on CO2. I did 37 shows on climate and weather, and I bought it when I first heard it. I'm done with that. I mean, you know, right. you're calling CO2 a poison. There's a problem. There's a
right.
problem.
Yeah, okay? Which is a natural thing.
Oh, my God. So I wanted to ask you one last question.
But it's all marketing, right?
So yeah,
it's marketing. All. It's how they tell you the narrative.
Yeah. You had said you do a lot of tests of the colon, right? You test people's colon. A lot of people have said it's actually a risky test because you could perforate the colon. Now, maybe many people that do it are not like you, but it depends where you are. I know it's a sensitive question because you don't want to say anything negative about some people who do it. But just so like there, it depends there, who there, you go to, location, and who you're going to that's
yes.
going to do this.
Okay, so
it's not to be taken lightly, correct?
Yes, correct. So colonoscopy saves lives, right? So colonoscopy is finding a polyp, removing the polyp, you know, prevents colon cancer. Colonoscopy has risks, right? And it's all in the hands of who's doing it. Now, there are websites out there. There are ways to know who your gastroenterologist is and their perforation rate. And, you know, it's
all. You think people can really know that? You think that's really available? I mean.
No, that is available. That is available.
Really?
There is. I forget the website, but I remember Googling myself and not Googling, but looking up this website. And actually, it was pretty accurate, like the amount of colonoscopies I've done in a year and then the amount of perforation. Because every surgical center has to report it. So every time I go to the surgical center in Beverly Hills and I do colonoscopies every month. They give me all my colonoscopies and they say infection, perforation, complications. What did you do? So, you know, I mean, I'm fortunate. I always go 000, but I know I can keep track of all the procedures I've done and I can keep track of the perforation. It is out there. I forget the website. I can look it up and then send it to you so if you could tell your people.
That would be good. Wait, are you the one that fills that out, though?
Yes, but
is it the doctor that fills it out?
But the center confirms it. So the doctor fills it out, but the center calls the patients. And so they know. The surgical center has a responsibility to tell if there's been a perforation. And also, that perforation is reported somewhere in some hospital and they report on it who was the gastroenterologist who perforated and all that. So there is some kind of a quality system on that. Now, you know, there are tests now that basically, you
Cologuard.
Know, that are Cologuard. Here's the problem with Cologuard. And I wish there were a little bit more.
I refuse to take it.
Yeah. Here's the problem with Cologuard. Cologuard has, you don't know if it's blood or if it's the marker that they've picked up from colon cancer. So I just wish Cologuard was a little bit more, you know, transparent about their test so that we as doctors would know, okay, well, this is the genetic or this is the blood in the stools. Because if it's blood in the stools, you know, from the food that the patient ate, let's say he had a raw steak last night. Well, the raw steak's probably going to present, right? If it is the food that's changing that test, I should probably know about it. So.
And they're expensive tests.
Oh, yeah, they're expensive. I mean,
$700 or whatever or
yeah,
more.
I think the future is going to probably be in the microbiome and we're going to pick up the bacteria. there's a lot of work already. There's a lot of work at Baylor University looking for a marker in the microbiome for colon cancer. We're looking for a marker in the microbiome for colon cancer, a group of microbes, like a formula that defines colon cancer. I think that's the key, right? That's eventually, if I had a magic ball, I would say, look, in the future, the microbiome is going to tell you whether you're going to have Parkinson's, whether you're going to have Alzheimer's, whether you're going to have a kid with autism. So it is going to predict. We are not there yet. Here, yeah, we're not there yet, probably about 20, 30 years from now, maybe 50. But that's going to be the future. The future is going to be a test. And, you know, we're entering the Gattaca era. So hopefully humanity is ready for it, where, you know, we are going to be testing people. And wouldn't it be nice to know, you know, when you're running for, when you have a candidate for presidency, if he's got a normal microbiome or if he's got some bipolar disorder going on or schizophrenia.
Or if he's senile, that would be good to know, like ahead of time.
Or Alzheimer's so I think, you know, the future, before you run for president, we should probably have a stool test to determine whether you're equipped to run for president.
This is too good. Listen, I want to ask you something. This is the last part.
Yes.
We're talking about a test here. You're talking about a test being available or yes. Maybe several tests, right? In the yes. coming years. However, if there's emergency use authorization being executed in a country, and let's say, just take here in the United States, since we're both here, and a test is concocted to test for something. I mean, it depends the forces that are intervening with this test.
Right.
So the test during the pandemic, that test was created by Dr. Kerry Mullis. Are you aware of this?
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Kerry Mullis, who was the inventor of the PCR test, who fought the medical industry, fought the pharmaceutical industry, and said it was being misused before he had a premature passing in August of 2019. So if the tests can be free to be true, accurate tests and not end up like that situation, which creates cases and not real sicknesses or, you know, diseases, mm-hmm, et cetera. Mm-hmm. If the tests can be free to survive that kind of influence, it's going to be the most incredible thing.
I think we need a body, not just government. We need a body of physicians to agree on that. You know, my whole interest, you know, when I started ProgenaBiome was really to bring on as many doctors to see this technology, bring on as many doctors to test it, to see if there's a validation to it, if it's useful, if it tells them, if it helps them improve their patients. Remember, we're in medicine to heal and save lives, right? Otherwise, why are we doing all this, right? If we cannot improve mental illness, if we cannot improve bipolar disorder, if we cannot improve Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, why are we doing all this, right? So my interest is to work with as many doctors around the world to, in a way, take back medicine, because unfortunately, medicine right now has been kidnapped by corporate entities.
For sure.
Kidnapped. Yeah. So we are not allowed to publish. Think about my paper with autism, not published yet. You know, I submitted a paper where an abstract where basically we are showing the, you know, hold on one second. Do you hear that noise?
Sure.
Do you hear noise? No. Okay, fine.
No, if it bothers you, I'll wait.
No, we're fine. So we are, you know, we're looking at, I forgot what I was saying now.
You were talking about the issue of publishing and that you can't publish
now.
This paper that you had on autism.
No, so I just submitted.
Publish.
Yeah, so I just submitted an abstract. I submitted an abstract, okay? And the abstract was spike protein injury, long hauler, vaccine injured, very similar. Some small differentiation, but very similar, okay? It wasn't even looked at because it's so controversial. Why is it controversial to do science? Why are we not allowed to ask questions? You know, the big thing that woke me up this pandemic was not, well, the first thing was treatment not allowed, right? You have to have FDA. Like I have to give epinephrine to an anaphylactic patient, but I have to call the FDA to give me authorization before giving epinephrine. That's how it felt, right? My patient is crashing from too much cytokines, from COVID. He's hypoxic, and I need to stop what I'm doing and ask permission to treat. No, that's not the way it works. I'm the doctor on the front line. We forgot as physicians how to be physicians. We forgot we had the power. We gave our power to the government agencies. The government agency, and I say this to people all the time, and you hear me on X, you know, the FDA is not my doctor. The NIH is not my doctor. The WHO is not my doctor. I don't need to listen to what they're saying. They're not even doctors that are speaking, right? So to me, once you realize FDA is not my doctor, the government is not my doctor, the president is not my doctor, I am my doctor. I am the doctor for my patient. I call the shots. In my office, it's between me and the patient. Everybody needs to step out of it because the liability is between me and the patient. If the government wants to get involved, when the government should have liability, the government should take malpractice. If the celebrities that are basically enticing people or influencing people to take these medications or vaccines, they should have a liability. If something happens to me and I listen to a celebrity because I liked them as a celebrity and I thought that they were cool and therefore I took the shot and I have a problem now, they're liable. They influenced me. That's going to be the future. Make no mistake of that. It just takes time for lawyers to get courage to start developing that. But the moment that the narrative is about influencing a patient, then that those people that are influencing should have the same liability that I have as a physician treating my patient, because I recognize my liability. I pay malpractice insurance for that purpose. If I tell a patient, you know what, take this and something happens to him, that patient can sue me, right? So it's between me and the patient. That patient. And it's a relationship, right? If I feel, you know, people come to me all the time and they want to fix, you know, Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, because nobody's really paying attention to Alzheimer's. There's no research on that, right?
Oh, there is a little bit. There is a little bit. By the way, Dr. Ben Beckman ruled it. Yeah, but not a huge amount.
There's no, nobody's coming out and saying, oh my God, I cured Parkinson's. And
my mother died of Alzheimer's. I can tell you, the only thing I can tell you just from experience, and I'm not a doctor saying this, is that it appears that there are multi-factor inputs in this. Yes. It's not like a one-trick pony.
No, 100%.
Like my mother had a lot of silver fillings. She was a smoker. She was on Fen-Phen to keep her, try to keep herself thin. She was beautiful, by the way. And if you ever want to watch the Mother's Day special I did on Joanne Greenhouse, you'll have a great time. Incredibly wild stories. Anyway, and but there were many components of it.
Yes.
But usually when people go in to study, they're doing like one thing. It's a one focus. And I think it's multi-factor.
And it's also multi-factor to treat it, by the way. It is not a one thing. You know, like fix the gut, right? So yes, I can fix the gut, but then you got to fix the brain. You got to fix the connection. So it's multi-factor as well. So, and you're absolutely right. There's multiple, you know, factors to all diseases, really. So, but I think the commonality that we're going to come to find out is that it is a demolished microbiome. So the key in the future is going to be, how do we prevent demolition, you know, a demolished microbiome? So the person smoking, and you're right, you know, that affects the microbiome. What can I do to offset the smoking behavior? You know, what can I do to offset the drinking behavior? What can I do to offset the antibiotics, etc.? So I think that's going to be, you know, the future. But here's the thing. If you censor the movement, you know, I always compare myself to this fast running train, and my team, my staff will tell you it's very difficult to work with me because I'm constantly like this, you know, there's no distractions. Like they talk to me and I'm like here, and people come in, and I always say it's a fast moving train. You come, you go, more people come in, they come back, they leave. I don't care, but it's still moving because we need to move the science. If we stop and we censor, we stop the science. And then when we're the patients, it doesn't help us. And that's the message out there. So I don't care, you know, I mean, obviously I care about Bill Gates and interference, and I care about like who he's listening to in the microbiome space. But here's the thing. He should care about what I'm saying right now, that interference with research is going to affect him. It's karma. It's just the way it is.
And I was using that example of him, by the way, as an example of somebody he listens to that is not necessarily paying attention to the microbiome. I was using Ray Carswell as an example about a whole other path that they're taking the physical body of humans.
Right.
That is counter to what you're talking about.
But it's all a business, right? It's also PR. It's if they shock you, they have your attention. You put them on stage, right? There's so, you know, you could see through, you know, on X, you'll see these things that are like just so out there, right? Like people are just dressed so ridiculous and just so out there. And they say things that are just so out there. And then it rouses you up. And so to the point that you share. So you're putting on stage those people. But if you just shut it down and not pay attention and don't look, they don't have a stage. You know, someone said to me, because, you
know,
sometimes.
That's a good point. I like that.
Yeah.
That's,
you know,
very astute.
Why are you, so my lab manager in my lab, when I get frustrated at things and I'm so upset at something, she's like, why are you letting that thing occupy your, you know, free rent in your brain?
Your mind. That's right.
Get it out. You have, your brain is so important to have other things in there, you know, to focus. So,
yes, exactly.
But that's what it's all about. It's all distraction. Because if they distract you, then they can,
you can't get done what you're doing.
They can recopy what you're doing and get more PR, right? So it's a distraction. And by the way, I recognize that, right, myself. Recently, that autism paper that I published where the kid improved, it was rejected by a journal. And the journal said to me, well, Dr. Hazen, we want to know what bioinformatics pipeline you've used. We want to know the depth of where you found those microbes. We want to know how you did the fecal transplant in more details. what are they asking me? They're asking me, give us your secrets of how you succeeded so we can copy you and make a business out of it and forget about the fact that you were the first one to do familial fecal transplant on a kid with autism, right? And obliterate my work. It's not going to happen like that, because here's the thing. So why do these journals do that? Because these journals are paid by pharmaceutical companies. They're paid in advertisement. Pharmaceutical companies continue the business. So, but eventually pharmaceutical companies are going to need something else, because they're realizing, look, there's only so many antibiotics you can sell. There's only so many biologics you can sell, right? You have to have a new thing. And the new thing is the new frontier is the microbiome. But, you know, I replied to the journal and I basically said, when you tell me what's in, you know, product X from pharma and what is exactly the components, then I'll give you my secrets. How about that? But, you
I'm
know,
sure they loved
the
you for that.
But pharmaceutical companies have yeah. secrets. You know, what's in Paxlovid? Sure. Do you know what Paxlovid is made up of? No. So, but when you look at the chemical composition of it, you can kind of have an idea. But I think the public has a right to know what's in Paxlovid. What is it made up, you know, of? Is it similar to, you know, something we know that's commonly used? So I think, you know, with transparency, pharma needs to start giving up transparency. But unfortunately, the whole business aspect is these trade secrets that stay secrets. You know, think about Coca-Cola. Nobody knows what's in Coca-Cola, yep. right? So you're drinking this addictive drink, but you don't know what's in it, right? So
you think the public really wants to see? I maintain the public really doesn't want to know what's in anything. Very few of the public. It's more a minority that are astute and that are becoming educated and aware and want to be aware and take responsibility for not only their well-being, but for the well-being of the people they love and care about. And if they did, they would be wanting to know what's in these jabs. I mean, honestly. They would want to know what's in them. Well, they'd want to know also what's in their water, what's in their water supply.
And like you said, I think the majority of people are very, you know, they're very happy living in oblivion, not knowing, and just every day focused on themselves and going on social media and showing what dress they bought and what glasses they're wearing and what drink they're drinking and just getting followers. And I think that's humanity right now, right? So it's a shame that it is that. But unfortunately, I think if people cared, we wouldn't be in the crisis that we are in this country.
So we need to call forth the people that are on the verge of caring, that want to care, maybe don't know how to care. Maybe you're afraid to find out what's in your water supply, what's the water you're drinking, what are you being injected with, what's in the pills you might be taking, what's in the supplements you're taking. It's all of it, right?
It's all of it, and I think it makes you a better consumer, a better human, a better, you know, a better person at making choices, the right choices, informed consent, right? So I think look, if you don't want to know and you're okay with taking a vaccine every 3 months, then that's your life, right? Your choice is your life. But then don't come back to me when you're having a problem and saying, I coulda, shoulda, woulda. You know, you made the choice, you know, live by your choice. The moment you start drinking, you know, a bottle of alcohol, what do you think is going to happen to you? You know, you're going to vomit blood at some point and call a GI doctor at 2 o'clock in the morning to sew up, to inject those varices in your esophagus. So, you know what's coming, right? I mean, you made that choice to drink a bottle of wine every night. You know what's coming. As long as people are prepared for that, then, you know, you got to pay the piper at some point. So I think, but what bothers me is the people those people that make those choices, you know, I'm okay. And they want to live in a life of, you know, being kind of misled or whatever. That's their choice, right? They don't want to know. Fine. What, you know, really bothered me in this pandemic is the people that were forced to take a shot to go to work. Those are the people that did not want to do it, but had to do it. And that, I think, was, in my opinion, was just not okay.
And nor was it okay to tell families and close relatives that they couldn't visit their family member in the hospital for the first time in our history.
Yes.
Okay. How many people died without, you know, a lot of times the family members, as you know, are the advocates for the patients. A lot of times.
Oh, my God. Yes. Yes. I mean.
And that was obliterated, just like, you know.
And if the person wanted to be exposed and risk their lives, they should have. That's, you know, but Texas allowed it. I know my husband, you know, went to Houston and stayed in the hospital with his dad. So.
Well, I want to thank you for your time, your focus, your expertise, your love of learning, your dedication to research and bringing through solutions that are not only needed now, but will be needed into the future. Dr. Hazen, how do people reach you? How do people go to your website?
Progenabiome.com. Everything's there. Our publications, our media, podcast, news. There's a contact number, phone number, and there's an email also they can reach me. And if they want to participate in our research, if they want to stand us stools, right now we're looking at moms that were vaccinated, who were pregnant and had a newborn. So if those moms want to give us their baby's poop, that would be awesome. So we could look at it. Always happy to look at the microbiome of a 100-year-old patient. So those are always, you know, my interest. The newborns and the old people are really my interest. But we're also looking at Parkinson's, autism. So, you know, Alzheimer's, we have a couple protocols going on right now. Like I said, I think the future is going to be in a formula of microbes, more precision medicine than just giving antibiotics. It's what you're missing that we're going to give you. And it's what you have overgrown that we're going to kill. So it's really about biome blasting and biome boosting. And understanding that relationship, you know, of how to kill precisely without killing the whole microbiome, or how to boost the good guys and kill the bad guys. I think that's going to be the future. And I think the future is going to be a lot of awakening from doctors. I think doctors go into medicine for the right reasons. I really believe that there's a lot of good doctors out there. They've been, you know, killed by the field, from, like, you know, legal and insurance is cutting them out, and then the hospital administrators and the insurance plans and the patients and the stressors and the challenges of not being able to fix a person with a chronic disease and trying to help them with whatever means they have. So I think the microbiome offers, you know, a way for doctors to kind of join together, to look at it together, to try to heal. I think that's the beauty, right? What we saw during the pandemic was a bunch of doctors just stepping up and trying to give protocols to people to heal. That's going to be the new frontier, is going to be doctors joining forces. And I think, you know, in a world of corporate America, if the doctors are taking charge and taking back medicine, corporate America cannot stand except working with those doctors and stopping the censorship and stopping doctors who are trying to do the good research, because unfortunately we still need doctors. And you're going to go to the hospital, whoever you are,
sure, absolutely,
capitalist, businessman, you're going to need a doctor. And so it's important to make sure our doctors have the right tools, but also the confidence to practice, and the courage and the bravery. So
it's a great honor to meet you and to be with you during the segment of It's Rainmaking Time. And to the public watching this, I want to invite you to share this with everybody you know and care about, and to come to It's Rainmaking Time and make comments on the site, what you related to, how it helped you, any information or insights you get from this. It makes a world of difference to other people coming in. Also, I want to invite you to watch the show that we did with Gavin Menzies and Dr. Tim Ball on peer review. It will shock you. Two totally different ends, academia and publishing, how peer review is really handled, how it impacts academia, how it impacts the people that are submitting the peer review, how it locks people out. There's a lot of the nuances behind the scenes that are not known to the public. Certainly I didn't know. And we thank you very much for being here. It's Rainmaking Time, Dr. Hazen. Thank you so much.
Thank you.